Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
HSUS.org. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his new book, Sex, Time, and Power, Leonard Schlain looks at the origins of the species and at sex, women's ability to refuse it, and how that fundamentally shaped human evolution. Schlain explores the roots of courtship and marriage today, tonight on Point, Sex, Time, Power, and Female Sexuality at the Heart of Human Evolution. We begin in Washington, where the Supreme Court today voted to uphold the soft money restrictions of the McCain-Feingold campaign reform law. Joining us now from the nation's capital is Fred Barbash, national correspondent for the Washington Post. Thanks for joining us, Fred.
You're welcome.
It was the campaign soft money restrictions versus free speech, as I understand it. How did the court sort this out?
The court didn't have much trouble, though it was narrowly divided 5-4, but the five led by O'Connor and Stevens had no trouble basically pushing aside the First Amendment argument and concluding that Congress is well established, was exercising its well established right to control fundraising and prevent the corruption or the appearance of corruption. They really didn't take serious the First Amendment argument, which is that somehow by regulating the giving and spending of money, you were interfering with political speech.
But they did take seriously the fear of corruption of the political system that Congress had its eye on when it passed McCain-Feingold.
They took that very seriously, though that to some extent they deferred to Congress on that. Basically, they said if Congress takes that seriously, we take it seriously, too.
Fred, put this in context for us. In the couple of years preceding the 2000 campaign, I think it's $500 million in soft money that was spent. What was the impact of that perceived to be?
Well, here's what happened. There's a 1976 law that fairly strictly regulates contributions and spending. The lawyers developed a way to get around that by channeling money through the state so that it would not be regulated. That way you could give as much and it could be as you want and it could be unreported.
Mm-hmm.
In the 2000 round of campaigns alone, they talk about $500 million, but most people think it was close to $1 billion. Part of the problem is you can't tell. And if you add it all up since they started this soft money technique, it's many billions of dollars, and I think that's what was the concern of Mr. McCain and Mr. Feingold. You don't know where it's coming from, and it allows individuals to do exactly what Congress decided they didn't want them to do after Watergate, where certain individuals gave as much as $1 million, $2 million, maybe even $3 million.
The court said in its decision, we are under no illusion that the law will be the last congressional statement on the matter. Money, like water, will always find an outlet. What has actually happened since McCain-Feingold's passage? The court is ruling on it today, but what's going on with that flow of cash that flows like water out there, Fred?
It's flowing just fine and in great abundance, and because they're are still, first of all, you can give money legitimately. Second of all, people are starting to create various kinds of foundations, like George Soros has done, to spend basically unlimited amounts of money on issues. And this is just the beginning, I'm sure, of an end run. The lawyers who do election law are really smart and really clever, and just like tax lawyers, quite able generally to find ways to do what they want to do that are within the law. So probably in another 10 years, there'll probably be another piece of legislation designed to correct whatever grows out of this particular decision that we got today.
But looking forward to that next round, that next challenge, does the court's decision today build a platform under Congress that's going to leave Congress feeling justified and constitutional in moving more aggressively on money?
This is a very strong endorsement of Congress's power to legislate in this area, much stronger than the previous, the first case, which was Buckley against Valeo. But what you've got to remember is that Congress acted very reluctantly. You may recall they really had to be bludgeoned into this. It took the Enron scandal and related matters to actually get them to move on. And McCain, Feingold, and their supporters had been really all but given up hope on it. So these laws affect incumbents, and it's generally very difficult to get them to do anything until there's a sort of huge scandal looming, bearing down on them, they think is going to affect public perception.
But the court's saying today, if you don't act on money in politics, don't blame it on us. We're giving you a green light, Congress.
Absolutely. The court has given them enormous leeway here. Essentially, the court has said there really is no First Amendment issue here at all. And that's what so upset the dissenters, particularly Justice Scalia, who called it one of the saddest days for the First Amendment in history.
Well, a 5-4 decision and pretty clarifying around exactly that issue. I suppose it could come up again, but the court quite clear on today. Fred Barbash, thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Fred Barbash is national correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with me from Washington. In his new book, Sex, Time, and Power, Leonard Schlein argues that the first key steps in human evolution were all about women. Women's sexuality was the life and death issue for early Homo sapiens, he says. And women's struggle to survive and make sense of that sexuality has shaped everything from the human sense of time to speech to human social structures today. In this hour, On Point, an exploration of women, men, and their evolutionary triangle of sex, time, and power. Do you see gender roles at the core of human identity? Is the negotiation over sex the cornerstone of human society? And if women made the first evolutionary leap, why didn't they stay on top? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Leonard Schlein. He's a practicing surgeon and associate professor of surgery at the University of California at San Francisco. His new book is Sex, Time, and Power, How Women's Sexuality Shaped Human Evolution. He's also author of The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, The Conflict Between Word and Image. Good evening and welcome, Leonard Schlein.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. I can't tell you what a stimulating read I found this. Absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
Clearly beyond your surgery, you are spending a lot of time thinking about evolution and evolutionary biology and evolutionary psychology, if there's such a thing.
Right. Well, this book came to me as a result of what I consider a catastrophe that occurred to the human species at its outset. Humans have two physical characteristics that distinguish us from all the other animals. The first is that we're the only bipedal heel-to-toe walking animal on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is that we have the largest brain per body size of any other animal. And those two things are basically incompatible for women. And the reason why is that when you stand up, all the birds and the mammals and the fish and the reptiles pretty much move with their vertebral columns horizontal to the earth, and we humans move with it vertical.
This came from climbing down out of the tree and getting onto the flatland.
Yeah, so when you stand up, a very interesting thing happens. You've now positioned a mass of intestines directly above your anus, which means that every listener is at risk for being turned inside out if they go for a stroll after a particularly heavy lunch. So therefore, the human pelvis is shaped differently than other animals. It's if you look at it, a picture of it is shaped like a big bowl. And the bony hole in the center of that pelvis is actually quite small compared to other animals.
And you describe the crisis that emerged when, I don't know if we call them women or pre-women, but as the evolution moved toward the Homo sapien and the brain of the newborn infant was growing larger and larger, the head getting larger and larger.
We added a whole pound of brain tissue beginning about 500,000 years ago. The last precursor species, Homo erectus, had a 2-pint brain, and we humans have, Homo sapiens have a 3-pint brain. So what happened at the outset, we now know that our species is about 150,000 years old, give or take 10,000 years from molecular biology.
Mm.
So the women, but not the men, had a problem. They had the largest brain baby sitting above the narrowest bony canal of any other species. And for the first time in any complex animal, women began to die in childbirth. I mean, there's no other species that has as high a maternal mortality rate as humans. There's no other species, and when the females go into labor, they call for help. So
you describe this, you describe this as a real kind of species crisis at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it's It's a very wasteful reproductive strategy. If you were an engineer designing the species and you were knocking off your healthy young females who are delivering their firstborn, you would be sent home. You'd be fired from your job. You'd never be allowed to design another species.
And yet that's what's emerged from our ancestors coming down from the trees, standing up on two legs, and addressing the challenges and threats around them, I guess.
Well, we stood up about 4.5 million years ago. Nobody's exactly sure why. But we were walking around for almost 4.5 million years, and then our brain underwent this hyperinflation routine. And what happened is when an environmental stress impinges upon a new species, like an ice age or a drought or a parasite or a predator.
Or a narrow pelvis with a big brain.
Well, it afflicts both the males and the females. Yep. But here you had a very unusual situation where it was the females but not the males that were dying. If you check the gravestones on any cemetery prior to the 20th century and you look at the ages at which women died, you see that up until very recently, maternal mortality was and is throughout the world a very leading cause of death among females. So the women needed to evolve enough mental cognition to figure out the connection between sex and pregnancy. I mean, there's 3 million sexually reproducing species on this planet, and there's nothing in their observable behavior to indicate that any of them have the slightest idea what the purpose of this function is for. But some woman somewhere has looked at some guy and said, wait a minute, this kicking in my belly is the direct result of that transient moment of pleasure I had with that guy over there 5 months ago. And then when she extrapolates into the future, she realizes that she could die as a result of getting pregnant, which is the result of having sex.
And from that flash of insight, as you portray it, almost everything else flows. The relationship between the sexes, human social structure, and on and on and on. In fact, you say even the human concept of time emerges in that moment of insight. Play that out in more detail for us.
Well, I mean, in order, you know, there's a lot of really smart animals in the world. I mean, there's dolphins and seals and dogs and, you know, you can have a dog and teach him some really great tricks, but the one trick you cannot teach a dog is you cannot say, Fido, I want you to meet me on the street corner in 2 weeks from now. The dog will not be there. I mean, other animals cannot hold constant in their minds long periods of time. We humans are separate from other animals in that we can make an appointment with somebody in 2 weeks and actually keep it. So in order to maneuver in the dimension of time, and that gives you foresight, and that is the invisible weapon that these puny 5-foot bipeds with no canines and no long claws were able to become the most fearsome hunters on this planet and make most of the other animals extinct because we can outsmart them. We know what they're going to do, and they don't know what we're going to do.
What did females do with that flash of insight into time, understanding of time?
For one thing, they gained a power that no other female of any other species has, and that's the power to refuse sex when they're ovulating. You know, other females of other species, when they're in heat or estrus or rutting season, you know, they got to have it. I mean, their hormones and instincts are driving them to mate. I mean, occasionally females get to choose which male they want to mate with, but there's no females of any other species that can decide to be celibate. Now, once the human gained the power to say no, that, as every man listening to this program knows, that changed everything because men now had to negotiate with the females in order to get them to say yes.
Which means men also had to come to terms with the idea of time?
Yes. Well, they eventually, you know, in the Genesis myth, it's the story of how Eve gains ego consciousness first and then she teaches it to Adam. Mm-hmm. And God punishes her by saying, you know, you will bear your children in sorrow and sometimes die in childbirth. Now, I think that all the elements of the Genesis story are there. They just happen to be in the wrong order. I mean, Eve did not commit original sin. She exercised original choice. And the stimulus for her to gain that knowledge was the threat of maternal mortality. So I believe that the reason the subtitle of the book is How Women's Sexuality Shaped Human Evolution, I think that the reason that there's only one animal on this planet that you can make an appointment with in 2 weeks is because the human female underwent the most extraordinary reconfiguration of her reproductive life cycle. You know, there's 3 million species, and the way it works in all the other ones, is, you know, with very few exceptions, is that the female gives off a real clear signal. It's usually an olfactory alert The males pick this up. They come from miles around.
And that's
they
it. It's on. Leonard Slane, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're looking at the evolution of the human species and human society around gender roles and female sexuality with Leonard Slane. He's author of the new book, Sex, Time, and Power. You can join the conversation. Do you see gender roles at the core of human identity, of human evolution? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with author Leonard Slane. He's a surgeon at the California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco, associate professor of surgery at the University of California in San Francisco, and author of the new book, Sex, Time, and Power, How Women's Sexuality Shaped Human Evolution. You can join the conversation. Is negotiation over sex the cornerstone of human society? Do you buy the view that it was women who made the first evolutionary leap and that men had to catch up to have a chance at sex? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Leonard Slane, right at the top of your book, you quote Franz Kafka, urging writers to create books that can be wielded like a pickaxe to shatter the frozen sea within the reader's mind. What's the frozen sea that you're chipping away at with your big thesis here?
Well, I'd like to think that all of my books, Art and Physics and Alphabet versus the Goddess, and now this one, will jog readers to think of human sexual relations for this book in a new way. I mean, I approach a lot of sacred conundrums of our society and attempt to give them an evolutionary reason. You know, as a surgeon who I've worked in the abdomen and the chest for many years, and I've been impressed with how everything works together so well. I mean, I'm in awe of how all the organs and the systems in the body fit together so well. So when humans develop adaptations that don't seem to be beneficial, then one has to ask, what is the offset? Why is this sitting in our genome? For example, there are 4,000 species of mammals. 3,999 of the females pump out litters of 6 and 8 and 10 and 12 kits, cubs, and piglets, and they don't have menses at all.
Mm-hmm.
There's a handful of mammals that have menses. Those that do bleed infrequently or bleed very rarely and don't lose large quantities.
So what's it mean?
The mammal that loses the most is a human female.
Mm-hmm.
And as a surgeon, I can tell you blood is a very vital substance. So what is the beneficial offset? What is the reason why this is sitting in our genome? And there's been no credible theory that I can have ever found that has been put forth to explain why this wasn't leached out generations ago.
What do you think?
Well, I think that the reason that women have menses is that it's coordinated with all the other women in the tribe or convent or dormitory at the same time, which is another very unusual feature of human females. Chimpanzees, gorillas, and baboons don't do that. We're primates. And the interesting thing is the conductor orchestrating this harmony is an inert object 250,000 miles in space, which is the moon. So the average length of a human female menstrual cycle is 29.5 days, and the lunar cycle is 29.5 days. Now, chimpanzees have a 37-day cycle, and bonobo chimps have a 42-day cycle, and gorillas have a 28-day cycle. So the odds of this being a coincidence are astronomical. I think that the changes in the female's reproductive life cycle were for the purpose of giving humans the key information they would need to recognize a pattern, and that pattern is essentially a month long. A month is a very long time for an animal to keep constant in its brain.
Now, let me just ask you that. You say for the purpose of this was as if this is purposeful. Are you?
Well, I'm talking about natural selection. I'm using a little poetic license here.
Okay, fair enough. So, but you mean that women who could track their cycle of ovulation by the phases of the moon were more able to
survive,
get a grip on the time kind of unit here.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
recognize
you know,
it.
The fact that we humans can maneuver in the dimension of time between past, present, and future, and all the other animals maneuver in the dimension of space, but they don't rarely move in time or no time, has given us an absolutely extraordinary advantage over the other animals. The reason that they're in our zoos rather than the other way around is primarily because we can anticipate what they're going to do, and they can't anticipate what we're going to do.
You're way beyond me in terms of thinking about evolution here in biology. How much of what you're describing is based in science, and how much is your projection deep into the past? Your kind of how scientific is this? I guess.
As you can see from the footnotes and the bibliography, I mean, I've done a lot of research on this. I mean, as a physician, I certainly took a lot of comparative anatomy and anthropology and biology and biochemistry and anatomy. So I'm, the scientific parts of the book, I believe, are very accurate. I haven't had anybody point out to me yet that there's any kind of a major mistake.
Well, let's set that aside then for a second.
Speculations, however, are mine, and they're a novel way of looking at what has always been a mystery as to why is the human female's reproductive life cycle so amazingly different from the other 3 million sexually reproducing animals.
Well, you plant that seed around the female sexuality and the reproductive cycle, and then from that you paint a huge mural of consequences. Move us on through that.
Well, I mean, the first insight is that women figured out the connection between sex and pregnancy. They taught it to the men, and the men became incredibly fearsome predators armed with this invisible weapon called foresight. And then the men made a terrifying discovery. That is that they're going to die. Now, women know they're going to die, but as a surgeon, I can tell you that men are much more frightened to die than women are. They take the news much harder. They across the board, they want more radical surgery, more radical chemotherapy if you tell them they have a terminal illness. In the early stages of the AIDS epidemic, the women were all rushing to take the test to find out if they were carriers, and the men were all just didn't want to know. So men took this fear, and they invented religions. Religions have a story about what happens to you after you die, and some man who could figure out that he was going to die and was grieving over this knowledge looked at some woman who was having a child and said, "Wait a minute, I had sex with this woman 9 months ago, and she's having a kid that looks just like me." And the concept of paternity occurs to him, and for the first time in any species, the man realizes that he could cheat death a little bit if he knows who his children are. He can be immortal if he gets to name his children. He gets to pass on his legacy to his children. But the problem is that no man ever knows for sure who his children are. A woman never doubts it. They literally come right through her. So the man walks up to the woman and he says, "I've been thinking about this, and we've been having a lot of fun having sex, but from now on, you have to be a virgin when I marry you, and I'll stone you to death afterwards, because that's the only way I can be sure that
I'll stone you to death if you're not faithful." You're saying,
"Yeah, because how else will I know for sure that these children are mine?" And she looks at him. She's got this power to say no, and she says, "Well, that's not really a good deal for me. I have a better one. How about if you stand up in a big public ceremony in front of all of our friends and family, all the people whose respect you cannot afford to lose, and you promise to keep me supplied with resources so that I can spend my time and energy raising these little ones that maybe will be yours, but this is your best shot."
Okay, we're getting a lot out here, and there's a lot more to come. I know, but I've got to ask you at this point, how far back in time are you projecting this? I mean, have cousins who are apes who are communicating is this 5,000, 10,000 years ago, or
no,
still back 150,000?
I think that there was we know that our species began 150,000 years ago. And for the first 110,000 years of our existence, we were no great shakes. I mean, we made some slightly better tools. We moved out of Africa. And then 40,000 years ago, something magical happened. It's called the creative explosion. It's also known as the Upper Paleolithic Revolution. And for some mysterious reason, humans began to bury their dead consistently. They started creating representational art. They made absolutely gorgeous grave goods. And none of those things happened before that 40,000-year mark. So what is it that happened 40,000 years ago that suddenly turned the lights on in our brains? Some people think that we had a massive brain mutation because we didn't change our physical form. But I think that a critical mass of humans finally figured out some key insights, and it's no coincidence that lunar calendars are first discovered about the same time frame. I think that humans became aware of time approximately 40,000 years ago, and that's kickstarted all of this extraordinary human culture of funerals and mortuary practices, body adornment, grave goods, and most importantly, representational art. because the art they left on the cave walls was light years ahead of the scratches on stones and bones that we find before that 40,000-year mark.
But all of this coming, you're saying, from a new sense of time, and with that foresight and the dynamics of reproduction and paternity.
Yes.
But where does the woman's power lie in all this? You started out saying,
well,
the woman kind of took charge and said, and unlike almost every other species, took advantage of the power to say no, realized that
right.
she might need to say no to avoid death. Most cultures started out with women. I don't know. Women were the goddess. Women were on top. What happens to the power?
Yeah, what happens to the power is that I've written this book from the point of view that the men have spent the last 150,000 years trying to regain the power they so emphatically lost when women gained the veto over sex. And, you know, men have constructed patriarchal societies that are misogynist largely to deprive women of two basic rights. The first one is to choose which lover she wants, and the second one is control over her reproductive rights. And when you read about societies that marry 12-year-old girls off to old men or practice honor killings or, you know, foot binding or chastity belts, what you're really talking about is men trying to control the fact that women have control over the male ability to leave a legacy. I mean, you know, when you see names on buildings and people leaving absolutely concerned about the paternity of their children because they want to bequeath their weapons, their name, their stocks, their bonds, because that's a way that men achieve a degree of immortality. So if you look at all of the cultural aspects of the male-female relations in the world today, and you look at the way major religions treat these things, you realize that behind it all is the male urge to try to deprive women of this power that they once had. So, you know, many women still have it. I mean, the men underwent an extraordinary adaptation in the opposite direction because whereas the women were gaining power over their sex drive, the men were losing it. I mean, you know, the human male is the most sex-crazed male of any other species. There's no male that's interested in having sex all the time. I mean, a stallion would never mount a mare who wasn't in heat.
But you said the same of females of other species and the human female.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, in many species, it's the female that solicits the sex. I mean, chimpanzees, lions, there's a whole bunch of species that the female actively solicits sex from the male. You don't find that in the human species because the women figured out this is a very potent power that they have, and they need to wield it judiciously.
Let me ask you something. If it was women in a desperate gambit to stay alive and not to die in childbirth with these infants who were coming with 3-pint brains instead of 2-pint brains and big heads that couldn't make it through the narrow pelvis, if they were the ones who had to figure out time, does that mean that they were ahead of the males of the species in evolutionary terms? And if they were, well, then are they still?
Yeah, well, I think that if you... You know, in the Genesis myth, it's Eve who gets ego consciousness first and then teaches it to Adam. I mean, I think that that's a pretty accurate assessment.
But how quick a study is Adam? I mean, are the genders essentially on the same plane, you know, 10,000 years later, 150,000 years later?
Well, I think that, you know, the beauty of humans is that, you know, insects, some animals can signal and other animals can inform, but the human is the only species that can ask a compound question and further dispute the answer. We have this thing called language. And you could learn something, and you could teach it to me, and I could teach it to the next person, and we don't have to wait for DNA changes in our chromosomes to pass information on from one generation to the next.
But you tie language back to female sexuality as well.
Well, I mean, yes, because I think that there are many theories as to why... what is the origin of human speech? Well, what was the reason why we needed to develop this extraordinarily complicated high-speed vocal motor speech? I mean, it seems to be more complex than we would need to have to just get along and survive in the world. I mean, you know, bees can have 22 different forms of their waggle dance, and chimpanzees have 35 recognizable calls and gestures. We humans have an infinite variety of words we can string together. And the question is, why? What was the impetus? What was the environmental pressure or bounty that caused it to develop speech? Now, there's a whole – I attended that conference at Harvard a couple of years ago on the origins of speech. And, you know, it's dizzying as to how many different theories there are. And I just wanted to add another one, which is that maybe we started to – one of the reasons we started to talk is that men and women needed to negotiate this very, very important aspect of their life called sex. Every man understands that he's not going to – no woman's going to walk up to them and solicit them for sex. They're going to have to negotiate with a female and make some sort of a commitment or promise, or something has to exchange hands.
Hence the phrase,
if he's going to get sex.
Hence the phrase, fast talker. Listeners, are you keeping up with our high-speed waggle dance tonight? We've got a lot out here, and we've been keeping a lot of callers waiting. I want to invite them in, Leonard Schlain, if I may.
Okay.
Noel is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Noel. You're on the air.
Yeah. You know, I would like to kind of weave something. I know this is kind of a complex story that your guest is weaving, and I agree with a lot of it, but what I think is that the concept of the male bringing home the goods was back in a time when the essence of life, food and some form of immediate shelter. And I think today, especially in the United States, we use symbolizations of that, which gets people into credit card debt, into car debt, and buying an expensive car but not having any savings seems to be the thing that a lot of people...
Well, you know, if you listen to the colloquialisms of our speech, you know, we say going downtown to make a killing or bring home the bacon. I mean, you know, it's the old hunter-gatherer language that we're still using superimposed on our current society.
Still bringing down the mastodon. So, Noel, what do you make of that?
Well, here's my point. And my point is that I think it's going to eventually bring down society unless we start recognizing that it doesn't take much to get the essentials. What is essential is the questioning of the motivation of the male who's bringing home this stuff, so that we can look at the Enrons and we can look at these other people and not glorify them, but first ask, what was your motivation in earning that money?
Well, the motivation seems pretty clear historically in Leonard Schlain's view.
Sex and power.
Noel, do you think that changes?
Well, I think that unless we do this as a society, we cannot export this concept of symbolization of power when we're really in debt to other countries around the world.
But they're human too. They're Homo sapien too, aren't they? I mean, don't the things work? Noel, our time is short before the break. Let Leonard Schlain pick it up. Leonard, what's your response?
Well, I think his point is that, you know, the difference between us and many other animals is that we have a higher level of ability to make choices. And, you know, we're still rooted in our animal nature, but at the same time, we have a overlay of veneer of cerebral cortex that allows us to make choices and intelligent decisions. Whether or not we're going to be able to override our degradation of the planet to maintain an unsustainable economy based on using up natural resources remains to be seen, but that's another whole discussion.
It's another discussion, but it sounds, I mean, from the thesis in this book, it may still come down to a kind of a male-female discussion or battling perspectives on the universe. Do you see a difference there now, or is it all male?
Well, no, I think that there's a difference between the male and the female agendas. You know, in the course of a month, the human female produces one egg. During that same period of time, a sexually active male can produce enough sperm to impregnate every single fertile female on the face of this planet today. Now, that makes a big difference in what their two agendas are. And because of the difference between the two, there's going to be conflict. And there is, and there has been.
Dr. Leonard Schlain, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking big expanses of time, big chunks of human behavior. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the evolution of the human species and human society around gender roles and female sexuality. My guest is Dr. Leonard Schlain. He's surgeon at the California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco, associate professor of surgery at the University of California in San Francisco. He's author of the new book, Sex, Time, and Power, How Women's Sexuality Shaped Human Evolution. You can join the conversation. Can you picture early female Homo sapiens discovering time in their scramble to avoid death in childbirth? Are the genders still playing out a drama established 150,000 years ago on the African savannah? If women made the first evolutionary leap, why didn't they stay on top? And are the genders equally evolved today? Are women still ahead? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jamie's calling from Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Jamie. You're on the air.
Hey, good evening. I first heard Dr. Schlein on Wisconsin Public Radio this summer, and unfortunately I missed his program, his slide presentation in Madison. First, I'd like to ask if that's available in another medium. And my question is, bring us the present day and beyond, going into the future. Where is this power going to be? Is it going to balance out? How do you see it?
Leonard Schlein.
Well, to answer your first question, you can go to my website, sextimepower.com. All one word. And to answer your second one, the end of my book talks about the evolution of the human species. I think that we're entering a transformative period because we've done something that the other animals have not been able to do, and that is figured out a way to pass on information other than DNA. You know, the limit of human intelligence was set by the diameter of the female's pelvis. You simply could not jam a bigger brain baby through that little bony canal. So our babies are born at 9 months when they should be born at about 18 months, according to calculations made on other primates. And what's happening is that our technology has changed us, because waiting for the baby on the other side of the mother's pelvic ring of bone are the missing pieces of the baby's brain. They're called culture. And we've evolved this extraordinary adaptation called language to ladle these pieces back in. And then we invented libraries and writing, and then we invented computers. The reason my computer is colored gray is it happens to be a piece of my brain sitting on the desk. It's just not wet. So what's happened is that we have exteriorized our nervous system with microscopes and telescopes and cell phones, and that has produced a profound change. I think that we are at the same point that we were 40,000 years ago, when the creative explosion occurred and we suddenly started creating art and burying our dead and making grave goods. We're in a transformative mode, and whenever something that being measured, it starts to accelerate to the point that it changes over from a arithmetic to a logarithmic curve, then what happens is the object being measured changes state. And I believe that we are in the process of metamorphosing into something else. It's not going to be a physical change. It's going to be something transcendental.
Transformative in what direction? Transcendental in what direction?
I don't know. I mean, I just know that if you were to tell somebody who didn't know it that you could take a hydrogen, which is an explosive gas, and combine it with oxygen, which is a combustible gas, and get water, no one would have believed that. Now, we've had many things. You look at caterpillars, they turn into butterflies, and you say, well, that's impossible, but it happens. And I think that humans suffer from a poverty of imagination. I mean, you know, most people think that the best thing that's waiting for them is that they're going to grow a pair of wings, learn how to play a harp, and never have sex for the rest of eternity. I mean, that's, you know, it's like what Hamlet said to Horatio, that there are more things between heaven and earth than exist in your philosophy. I just don't think that we are perspicacious enough to be able to anticipate what is going to be the major change that's going to happen to the species.
But you do think we're approaching another one of these
transformative moments? Well, I know that we can't possibly continue going at the rate that we're going without something major interfering. Either we are going to become extinct and make the planet extinct or nearly extinct, or something different is going to happen and we're going to transform into something else. I mean, caterpillars are the most rapacious insects, and then they use up all their resources to go into their cocoon. And when they emerge, they're butterflies that are no longer rapacious. They just go from flower to flower to pollinate other flowers.
Listeners, do you feel that inner butterfly tonight? Lisa's calling from Peabody, Massachusetts. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Great to have you.
I just have one comment. I've been listening to the conversation. I think it's really compelling. But my problem is that I believe that the doctor here feels that I think he's already coming at the conversation in a paternalistic, kind of male-oriented perspective, in that I think it's been proven, I've studied anthropology, and I think it's been proven that women in gathering provided over 80% of the food source of indigenous and, you know, early human.
Yeah, they still do.
And so what do you take from that, Lisa?
And so I'm just saying that this perspective that, you know, women kind of, you know, change the time, I just feel like it's already, I think, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little flustered.
That's all right. You see a kind of male orientation in the whole interpretation of what's happened.
Yeah, I feel that the doctor is coming at it still like male oriented, kind of paternalistic.
Well, Leonard Slane, you want to pick that up? And Lisa,
yeah,
thanks for your call.
Lisa, I want you to know that I've got only 20 minutes to outline a book that's 400 pages long, and I've certainly pay much attention and document the fact that women in hunter-gatherer society do bring in the majority of the calories. However, the studies that were done were basically on fringe hunter-gatherer societies that are marginalized in our society today. You have to remember that humans left Africa about 70,000 years ago. As long as we stayed in equatorial Africa, then the pickings were easy. It was no big problem. But unwittingly, we walked smack right into the teeth of the worst ice age that's hit this planet in a long time. And there's not a whole lot of vegetables you can pick off of trees during a winter that has glaciers covering Yosemite 2 miles thick. So what happened is the human diet underwent a rather remarkable transformation. You know, there's 270 species of primates, and 269 of them are principally vegetarians. I mean, chimps and baboons eat a little bit of meat, but for all practical purposes, shoots, roots, nuts, and fruits is what they eat. The most fearsome predator on this planet is the human male. So the question is, what would have been the impetus that would have made males, who are basically prey animals, that's what primates are, they run like hell from danger,
mm-hmm.
Why would we have suddenly developed this infusion of courage and bravery and take on attacking woolly mastodons, you know, woolly mammoths that weigh 30 times what we weigh?
And here, too, it comes back to female sexuality, you say.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I make the argument in the book that when a woman menstruates, she loses iron. Iron is a critical substance that drives hemoglobin, which is what carries oxygen back and forth from your lungs to your brain. Human females have 15% less hemoglobin, hematocrit, and red cell count than males. Their urinalysis values are the same, and so are their Chem26 panel values, such as sodium and potassium, are the same. Why this disparity? And it isn't clinically significant unless the woman gets pregnant, and then she has growing within her abdomen the fastest growing fetal brain of any other species. That brain, in order to develop normally, must have an enormous amount of iron. And then she delivers this baby in the most traumatic delivery of any other species. Anybody who's ever attended a live human birth comes away deeply impressed with how bloody the whole affair is.
We've got less than a minute. You're saying the men had to go out and bring home the meat to support
that? I'm saying that we switched over from essentially a vegetarian mode, and the vicissitudes of Ice Age Europe and Asia caused Homo sapiens to become very diligent hunters. And the men that brought home the most meat were the men that the women honored by giving them the most sex. And I know that sounds crass, but if you walk into any romantic restaurant, you'll see some young man in the corner spending his valuable hunting money wooing some young woman. And what's he offering her? I mean, tofu's not going to do it.
Leonard Slane, you take us on a long trip in a hurry. Thanks for this high-speed tour of 150,000 years. And thanks for the new book, Sex, Time, and Power. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Leonard Slane, author of Sex, Time, and Power, How Women's Sexuality Shaped Human Evolution. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, this year's Nobel Peace Prize winner uses her acceptance speech to deliver stinging criticism of the East and the West. This is On Point. Iranian lawyer and human rights activist Shirin Ebadi was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize today in Oslo, Norway. She is the first Muslim woman to be awarded a Nobel Prize. Ebadi's acceptance speech was critical of Iran's conservative Islamic government, but she delivered a much sharper rebuke to the United States and other Western nations for using terrorism as a pretext for what she sees as a violation of universal human rights laws. In a silent expression of her battle for freedom, Ebadi appeared at the Oslo podium without the traditional hijab, or headscarf, that women in Iran are required to wear. Shirin Ebadi delivered her speech in Farsi, her native language. Here is an excerpt in English translation.
بنام خداوند جان و خرد In the name of the God of creation and wisdom. Your Majesty, your Royal Highnesses, honorable members of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I feel extremely honored that today my voice is reaching the people of the world from this distinguished venue. This great honor has been bestowed upon me by the Norwegian Nobel Committee. I salute the spirit of Alfred Nobel and hail all true followers of his path. This year, the Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to a woman from Iran, a Muslim country in the Middle East. Islam is a religion whose first sermon to the Prophet begins with the word recite. The Quran swears by the pen and what it writes. Such a sermon and message cannot be in conflict with awareness, knowledge, wisdom, freedom of opinion and expression, and cultural pluralism. The discriminatory plight of women in Islamic states, too, whether in the sphere of civil law or in the realm of social, political, and cultural justice, has its roots in the patriarchal and male-dominated culture prevailing in these societies, not in Islam. This culture does not tolerate freedom and democracy, just as it does not believe in the equal rights of men and women and the liberation of women from male domination, fathers, husbands, brothers, because it would threaten the historical and traditional position of the rulers and guardians of that culture. One has to say to those who have mooted the idea of a clash of civilizations or prescribed war and military intervention for this region and resorted to social, cultural, economic, and political sluggishness of the South in a bid to justify their actions and opinions, that if you consider international human rights laws, including the nation's right to determine their own destinies, to be universal, and if you believe in the priority and superiority of parliamentary democracy over other political systems, then you cannot think only of your own security and comfort, selfishly and contemptuously. A quest for new means and ideas to enable the countries of the South, too, to enjoy human rights and democracy while maintaining their political independence and territorial integrity of their respective countries must be given top priority by the United Nations in respect of future developments and international relations. The decision by the Nobel Peace Committee to award the 2003 prize to me as the first Iranian and the first woman from a Muslim country inspires me and millions of Iranians and nationals of Islamic states with the hope that our efforts, endeavors, and struggles towards the realization of human rights and the establishment of democracy in our respective countries enjoy the support, backing, and solidarity of international civil society. This prize belongs to the people of Iran. It belongs to the people of the Islamic States and to the people of the South for establishing human rights and democracy. If the 21st century wishes to free itself from the cycle of violence, acts of terror and war, and avoid repetition of the experience of the 20th century, that most disaster-ridden century of humankind, there is no other way except by understanding and putting into practice every human right for all mankind, irrespective of race, gender, faith, nationality, or social status. In anticipation of that day, with much gratitude, Shirin Ebadi.
The 2003 Nobel Laureate for Peace, Shirin Ebadi, speaking this morning in Oslo. Our English translation was read by On Point's Meghna Chakrabarty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.